having a horrible week? Well, hang in there, because we are back with your favorite Avatar The Last Airbender rewatch podcast. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Zach Muhammad, and I'm joined by my good friend and co-host, Jacob Redman. Jacob, how you doing today?
I'm doing well, Zach. This has been a pretty good week. It's been a week filled with some phone games, trying to find the official hang in there phone game. So I'd say it's one of my most productive weeks, you know?
Honestly, I had a good week as well. I cannot complain too much. Admittedly, though, I did have a bad Sunday morning. I had some gastrointestinal distress a la Stephen Fishback, our fellow Rob Has a Podcast podcaster on Survivor Second Chance. So that's why we're recording a little later than usual, but the podcast will be coming out at the exact same time. So no big deal.
Yeah, none of you will know that it's coming a bit late. You might just notice that we'll have some late night vibes recording Monday night as opposed to our usual Sunday morning. You know, I feel like cartoons are meant for the mornings. So maybe this will become a drama podcast. Who knows?
Well, this episode did have some comedy. It did have some seriousness. So we'll see if our podcast gets a little more serious than usual due to the late night vibes. But I'll be honest, I kind of like this evening podcast. I mean, we don't do it often because Jacob is an employed individual and I am currently unemployed. But this is like, I was able to eat a good lunch. I was able to come in and chill. I don't know. I kind of like this evening podcast, to be honest.
Yeah. Maybe we can get some more late night podcast vibes going. See how this one goes. We'll see first.
But. Was there a front runner for the Aang in their official app? Do you have an app that really fancied you, that really caught your eye when you were playing it?
Well, so I tried a few. Some people in the patron Discord suggested a few games, so I tried those for sure. So one of the ones I tried, you know, classic, just nice little temple run. It kind of matches the whole like Aang and Avatar thing because they're running away from something. It's like super agile, but that game just hasn't updated. It felt a lot like.
Do you remember your temple run high scores, Jacob? I think I remember mine. I think I was up. I was in the millions with Once Upon a Time.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, I was up there.
I was in the very low millions, as in I got to 1 million and then started bragging about it.
Yeah, because I remember back in my phone, like back when I played the most phone games, probably in high school when I first got my iPod Touch and my horrible like ghetto touch screen phone or whatever that I ended up getting. So that was like the apex of my phone mobile app playing days. But yeah, I don't know. For me, I stick to the word games. I like Sudoku. I'm like an old white man now when it comes to my mobile game playing. What about you, Jacob? Besides like for Aang in there, do you actually like play a bunch of mobile games in your day-to-day life?
This is a little embarrassing, but I did play some of those like simulator games where you just like, it's like the idle things. You just like tap a bunch and then get to leave for a day and come back and you have more stuff.
Do you have an example of that? Like, is there a popular one of these? Because I don't know if I'm familiar with the genre.
Okay, so my favorite one's called Pocket Planes. I get to set up my plane empire. I get to buy planes and then have like flights that I get to ship. But there are other ones. There's like an idle courier or like, I don't know. They have all sorts of idle games, but Pocket Planes is the best one. But that's not the best app that I tried for this week. The best one is Super Brawl Universe. Have you ever played Injustice?
Yes, the Injustice video. So the DC game based on Mortal Kombat. Yes, I have played Injustice.
Yeah, so it's just like a bunch of DC characters fighting each other. Mm-hmm. Super Brawl Universe is the same thing, except it's Nickelodeon characters fighting each other. So it's like SpongeBob fighting Aang. I played that.
Oh, and they have all the official Nickelodeon app. Wow. That's a perfect game to represent the point. Honestly, no joke. I got my new little, or not new, but I got an S7 Edge recently off of Fred. Maybe I'll download some Super Brawl Universe after this.
Yeah, I have to say the actual fight mechanics kind of sucked, but it was fun to play as Aang. I didn't unlock Korra yet, but I think I'll keep trying until I can get Korra. That's where I am. I also tried Run with Ryan, by the way. It was suggested by a listener. It's just Subway Surfers, but with the kid from Ryan's Toy Review.
He has an app? Oh my gosh.
It's I can't believe it.
I can't believe that exists. I'm shocked. Delete that from your phone immediately.
Done.
We are an anti-Ryan's Toy Review podcast. Especially his I don't even hate Ryan. I honestly hate his parents more, but we'll leave that for that. In fact, we've got pretty far off the deep end, but this is a fun little first 5 minutes of the show. So about this episode, Return to Omashu. What were your initial thoughts? Like, did you like this episode? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, this is an episode that I think I really enjoy, but it's odd because anytime I've watched this episode, I think I watch like the Cave of Two Lovers and Return to Omashu and maybe even the Swamp like all at once. Like I'm doing like multiple episodes at a time. Mm-hmm. So for this podcast, I just watch the one episode for the week so that, you know, I don't get too far ahead of myself. And when I'm like going back to watch Return to Omashu, and then when I watch it a second time, I kind of felt like it was a solid episode, but I feel like it's better in a binge than standalone. Did you have the same feeling?
Yes, I would agree with this because I enjoyed this episode. I actually liked it, but I also feel like a lot of it is like exposition and set up for what's to come. So this episode, we get the introduction of May and Ty Lee. And it's like, if you're a viewer who's already binged the show prior, like myself and Jacob have, and I assume many of the listeners of the podcast have, because we have a lot of spoilers. So if you did not finish the show prior to listening, then I'm sorry. But so I assume most of the people listening have done that. And like, this is an episode where if you're in a binge and stuff, you kind of like, you got like a lot of the plot points, you're yada because you already know, you know, Ty Lee and May are going to join Azula, you know, a lot of the stuff that's about to happen, you know, Boomy is not going to end up as Aang's earthbending teacher, Toph will assume that role in a couple of episodes. So I think I see what you mean here, Jacob.
Yeah, and honestly, thank goodness that Boomy is not the teacher. Like, I love Boomy. Boomy's super fun, but good in small doses. Boomy's not someone that you want all the time. And Toph is that great character that I think everyone's so happy that Boomy's not freed here. Like,
and I like how they use Boomy in this episode as well, too. Yeah. Just to add on to your point.
No, ultimately, this is a good episode. Like, I enjoyed it for sure. But when I think back on this episode, Return to Omashu, it's like, oh, yeah, we get to see Boomy again. Like, we get introduced to May and Ty Lee. And yeah, I think it like, good, not great. I think we've had better episodes and better episodes are still to come. So there you go. That's my initial review.
Yeah, I'd agree with that take. I think season two, in my opinion, really picks up when Toph is introduced, which we'll get to soon. But these initial episodes are good. And honestly, after last episode, I kind of liked, I was like, okay, I wanted more of Azula last episode. We didn't get any. So it was a pleasant like thing to see her quite involved in the plot this week in Return to Omashu. So I guess on that note, shall we dive straight into the episode?
Yeah, let's get into it. We pick up like seconds after the last episode ends off. The last episode, we see Sokka and the rest of the gang going up and seeing Omashu has fallen. The next thing that we see is, so now like Omashu's fallen. We see the Fire Nation has Omashu and Aang is saying that we still have to go into the city to find Boomy. He's trying his hardest to convince everyone and no one else is really that convinced.
Yeah, Sokka and Katara, especially Sokka, seems to want to move on quickly. And I think, what does Katara say? She's like, well, you can just find another earthbending teacher. And Aang replies, he's like, it's not about him being my teacher. It's about finding a friend, which I think is correct on Aang's part, honestly. Or like, that's the fit. Like, I can see why he's thinking in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you there. It does make a good bit of sense from Katara and Sokka's perspective. Here we have Sokka say, like, we don't even know if Boomy's still, and then he, like, sort of says around. But, like, I think this is fair. Like, the Fire Nation, if they were at all competent, probably would have just offed Boomy.
They should have. Yeah, I don't know why they just trap him. Well, I guess we could get to that, but that's a very good point. Why did the Fire Nation not off Boomy? You have this like insanely powerful king that actually, like, to the viewer, Boomy does not command the respect that he actually does in the show. Because when I'm watching, I'm like, oh, he's just this goofy moron. But then when you see in the show, they're like, oh, this clever, crafty king, I think they describe him later on in the episode. So Boomy commands a lot of respect. I don't know why they wouldn't just snuff him right there, but
Yeah. I mean, I agree. Expected value is that Aang goes into the city, realizes the Bumi's dead, and is like, okay, well, that sucks, and leaves. So,
yes.
You know, Sokka and Katara make a lot of sense. Obviously, you know, it's a fun TV show and not like a sad
true, movie. True.
If this was truly late night vibes, then Bumi would be gone. Bumi would not be here.
No, you're 100%. If this was the version of Avatar where Azula's just like disintegrating her captain, then maybe Bumi would be dead. We'll see.
Yeah, and maybe we get an actual zombie outbreak as opposed to just the references to him. That would
true. So we should get to that actually. So
Walking Dead.
They find a secret passage within the sewers, and they show you a shot of like Aang bending a bunch of air between them, so they don't bending a bunch of air between them and like the sewer muck. And then could you see them hop out of the sewer? Katara's like, "That's not as bad as I thought." But then you see Sokka coming out of the sewer. My gosh, how would you describe it? He looks like a swamp monster, and he's like covered in these purple pentapus is the term for this creature. But do you have any more descriptors to talk about here, Jacob?
Yeah, Sokka ends up looking like the swamp monster that we'll see next episode, just like totally green, covered head to toe. And that's got to be rough. You know, usually being the non-bender of the group, Sokka gets the short end of the stick. But here it is way worse. Sokka gets covered in this disgusting sludge from the underground of the city. And yeah, even with the quick work of the water bending and air bending to dry him off and get all the sludge off, he's still not very good because, as you mentioned, Zach, he has these purple pentapus all over his face.
But luckily it's going to work out because they run into some guards and he tells the guard he has pentapox because he's covered in like, it kind of looks like he has chicken pox. He's covered in these red splotches. And the guard says, Hey, I think I've heard of that disease. My cousin Trang has died of it. Like, I don't know how he thinks he's heard of this fictional disease, but apparently there must be some other pox going around because we see the governor later on in the episode also say, I too have heard of this disease, even though Sokka just made it up. So some quick thinking from Sokka here.
Yeah, it's one of those like Mandela effect type things where as soon as you hear it, they're like, oh yeah, I've definitely heard of that. But like, it's totally made up and just like a figment of their imagination. I do think it's good. One of the guards says that they need to go wash their hands and burn their clothes. I'm glad, you know, and we've been in a pandemic for a while now, like good pandemic behavior to wash.
True, they're treating that virus more seriously than the average citizen did COVID, sadly.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I did not burn any clothes during the pandemic. So I think I'm actually slacking behind the Fire Nation.
Really?
So.
I burned every single thing in my wardrobe. This hoodie you see me wearing on camera is the only thing I own, actually.
All right. Well,
I'm in a hoodie and nothing else. No, I've got.
Wow, we're getting really late night vibes.
True. Oh man,
don't worry. Exactly.
Myself as some like weird sexual deviant. It was a joke. Everybody listening.
No, we've got off the rails already.
True.
By next week, Zach, I'll join you. I'll burn all of my clothes.
Oh, perfect. Well, yeah. I mean, I got to do. That's what you got to do in a pandemic, right? Burn everything you own. So since I got us far off topic, I'll get us back on topic. So the next scene, we cut to Azula. She's getting advice from Lo and Lee, her like main advisors. They're basically telling her she needs to stop traveling with the royal army, and Azula agrees. She says she needs a small covert group to track the Avatar, and this will lead into what we'll see later with Ty Lee and May. Anything you wanted to stop down and talk about on this scene, Jacob? Pretty short, really. Yeah, scene, honestly.
So I know this is just like a plot device, right? Like they want to introduce May and Ty Lee. Mm-hmm. They need some justification in order to have them like come on, which is like, that's totally fair. But I actually think this is a terrible take. Like Azula should have kept the royal procession. They're not dead weight. Like have these people dress up as secret service agents, like have them steal some earthbender clothes, infiltrate the city as regular people, like have the whole walkie-talkie like thing set up or whatever it takes. And like, I think that you can have a way to use the royal procession to help you out.
You're right. But then I can, at the same time, I can see why she wants to shed the royal procession because it's too obvious. Like Aang and Sokka and Katara are too smart. They've been tracked for like what, months on end now. So they can tell when a large procession of firebenders is following them. Whereas Azula is able to like essentially sneak up on them with Ty Lee and Mei. And plus Ty Lee is at least worth like 10 of the average soldier grunt. Like, okay, you know what I mean? Just her, in my opinion, at least, but
yeah, I guess, Zach, if you do have friends as skilled as Mei and Ty Lee, then you don't need a royal procession.
Yeah, exactly. If she had like two grunts with her and that was it and just her, then I don't know, you might as well have the whole procession anyways. But with Mei's knife throwing and Ty Lee's like instant paralysis martial arts style, I think it's fine.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. The next thing that we jump to is Katara saying, like, hey, let's get Bumi and get out of here. Sokka asks the question, where would they keep him? And Aang says, somewhere where he can't earthbend. Is Sokka not smart enough to figure that out? Like, that seems like the easiest thing. He knows that the Fire Nation keeps earthbenders when they go to prison in some sort of metal contraption. Like, Sokka couldn't do this, easy put two and two together.
Sokka, I'll stump for Sokka a little.
All right.
It's mostly me playing devil's advocate because honestly, Jake is completely right. But for the sake of this podcast, not to have it because I'll stump for him a little bit. I think Sokka for him, maybe he's an abstract thinker. You know, he's not the one who's going to come to the obvious conclusions. So, but you need his outside the box thinking when you got like the when you got a war going on. You need somebody to come up with. Sokka's not going to come to the obvious conclusion. But he'll come to these non-obvious conclusions when it comes time for war and stuff.
All right. You know what? I can accept that. I don't like it, but I'll accept it.
Yeah, no, because you're right. How the hell did he not come up to, in all seriousness, how did he not come to this conclusion? Yeah. Why even ask this question? Because it's so obvious. But hey, Sokka's smart sometimes, dumb other times. So what can you do? Well. That's why we love him.
Yep. Just as he asks that question, we see the scene switch to a young woman in a long dress with long black hair and absolutely no emotion on her face. This is the amazing Mei.
What an introduction. What an introduction.
I love Mei. Mei is like so cool. Mei is what I aspire to be. Someone who has no emotions like 90% of the time, but then when she feels is like actually cares for people. That's my goal.
Honestly, I've just never met such an ardent fan of Mei prior to talking to you, Jacob. Most of the people, because I know a lot of people watch Avatar, most of the people are either indifferent to Mei, and that's pretty much it. And I've never met somebody who has such a strong passion for Mei as a character. So I'm glad. I'm glad to have that opinion relative to mine. Because every time Mei's on screen, I'm like, eh. Even Ty Lee, everybody loves Ty Lee. And like, I've always been enamored with Ty Lee's fighting style, which we'll get to in the final scene of the episode. But even Ty Lee and Mei's characters, I don't know. Of the three of them, I'm Team Azula all day. She's my favorite by far.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. You're comparing Mei to one of the best TV villains.
True. I don't mean to cuss, but it's a basic bitch mentality of mine. I'm just choosing the easiest character to stand of the three. So no, I respect you for enjoying Mei as a character. For me, I don't know, every time she pops on, she's just so dry, so boring. It's her character, but I don't know. I like seeing the gang be upbeat and cracking funny jokes and stuff. Mei's just too depressing every time.
No, she has some funny jokes. You know,
she does.
I'll mention them as they
she even has some in this episode. You are correct. But most of the time she comes on screen, I'm just like, yeah, I don't know. I'm so indifferent to Mei, honestly.
I like the type of people who are just like bored out of their mind. Like Mei's over it. She doesn't want to be here, especially in this scene. Like her mom's like, oh, your father was appointed governor. Like we're royalty. And she just doesn't care. She doesn't want to be there at all. She's just looking for something exciting. And I think she has a moment in season three where she betrays Azula that shows you how much she cares about some people. Spoiler alert in case you haven't seen it, but you probably should have. Anyway, that moment is so good. And like just Mei being Mei is something I'm here for. So.
You know what? You're spitting facts right now. And I want to talk about that point you just stated, how Mei is so bored in this. So her father has been appointed the governor of Omashu and they're living like kings, essentially. They're living quite lavishly, but Mei doesn't like the stereotypical royalty lifestyle. And unlike Ty Lee later on in the episode, I'm skipping ahead a bit, but Mei actually willingly wants to join Azula and like go along with it, whereas Azula's ripping Ty Lee from a life she loves. On the other hand, Mei, at least at this moment in time in early season two, is definitely Team Azula. She's like, yeah, something to get me out of this like basic boring life. So that's a good point to bring up with Mei.
Yeah, it's actually really funny. So in the next scene, there's like a big rock waiting at the top of the mail delivery chute. And some of the people of the resistance were like, okay, the targets are coming. Like, take them out. Like, let's fight. Aang then like hits back the rock, trying to like stop anyone from getting hit. And Mei like finally looks happy. Like, Mei has no emotion, but then she's like, oh, someone wants to attack. She cracks that little smile and she goes right into it. This is what I was here for.
Yeah. And Mei lives for these battles and stuff, because Mei wants anything, as long as it's not her boring, like living like a princess life. She wants to fight. She loves any excuse to throw those throwing knives Mei can get. She's going to throw them. So yeah. You are 100% correct about that.
Yeah. So Mei leaps into action here. She starts running towards Aang, throwing these small little like throwing spear, tiny arrows at him. Aang's able to avoid them, nimble as he is, but she keeps coming. She's like running after him, ready to go. Then a few other Fire Nation people roll up. Aang, Katara, and Sokka and Momo are running away as the other guards are climbing the ladders. And I love this Mei fighting style, like the small little invisible like attacks.
I agree with you, but I think Mei's fighting style is held back by the PG nature of the show. And I say that because just like how whenever she throws the knives, and I think we've actually talked about this on the podcast before, maybe one of the season one episodes, whenever she throws the knives, you know, she's not going to like hit anyone in any vital point. Like the best she can do, because it's a PG show, is like kept like throw the knife around their clothes and like catch a piece of fabric, essentially. That's always been my issue with her fighting style. It's like, if this was a PG-13 show, Mei would be a very formidable opponent. Like, oh my, she can aim precisely with these throwing knives. Like, that's a very, like, a great power to have, honestly. But in the scope of Avatar's, that's why whenever Mei fights, it just feels so inconsequential to me, because I know no one's ever going to be hit with these knives ever. And sadly, I don't think, actually, like, she ever, like, does anything really truly crazy with these knives. It's disappointing, honestly, because I felt like her fighting style had so much potential, and that's one thing the show doesn't really utilize.
Yeah, that's fair. Like, she's obviously not gonna like poke anyone's eye out with these small arrows. Yes. Like, she's not gonna be, you know, landing some deadly blow here.
But the fight scenes with the style are so cool at the same time. Like, every time Mei is in a fight, it's like, oh, the stakes are higher, because like, oh, she's throwing knives all over the place. And I always think all the fights between Team Avatar and Azula, Ty Lee, and Mei, those are some of the best fights in season two, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think, like, you know, Mei's obviously not going to like take anyone's eye out or like poke someone in the arm, but I do think that it helps have the fight have really natural flow, because it's able to go from her character throwing the arrows and then into the other character. So it like leads to the natural transition, as opposed to like these smash cuts between fights.
No, you're right. That is true. And I feel like a lot of the Mei fight scenes do have these like cinema, especially it's always like Aang, even in this scene right here, Aang like nimbly avoiding the throwing spears. I thought this, I don't think we'll rate it as a fight, but I did enjoy this, because actually what ends up happening, Aang inadvertently saves Mei and the governor. Actually, I think had he known they were Fire Nation, maybe he should have just let them bolt. Not that Aang would, he's a pacifist, but maybe he should honestly just let the boulders hit him.
Yeah, Aang does make a little mistake here by saving him so quickly, at least cause him a scare, because they are able to start flying or climbing up next to him. Like Mei's charging at Katara. She throws these like small arrows and Katara raises a shield of water, turns it into ice and protects herself just in time. Mm-hmm. They chase each other around. A lot of chasing here, a lot of just like, you know, causing the scaffolding to fall. Aang like sweeps the scaffolding and causes it to fall on Mei. And then right as that happens, I believe that is when they go underground. So Aang, Katara, Sokka, and Momo are swallowed up by the ground. A nice little trapdoor that could not have been seen swallows them away.
Does this episode have the most chase scenes of any episode we talked about, do you think?
It's getting close, yeah.
Because the most minutes of chase on screen, I'll say, because this episode ends with like what, a 6-7 minute chase sequence in a 22-minute episode. Like it was long, I'm pretty sure. Plus, if we count the 2 minutes of Mei chasing Aang here, that's a lot of chase.
Yeah, you're definitely a lot of chase for sure, because yeah, you have the like 2 minutes here, you've got the 6 minutes at the end. Mm-hmm. But I don't mind. You know, we're getting to see Mei give her best impersonation of Sheik from Legend of Zelda.
True, Sheik was my main in Melee, fun little
fight. Oh, really?
Yeah, I like Sheik. I mean, I'm not, don't get me wrong, I was never that good at Smash, but Sheik was my girl, I guess, girl, guy. Yeah. Not 100% sure about that, but
Sheik sends those small little arrows to where if you're not prepared for them, you don't know what's hitting you, and it's very frustrating. I feel like
that's the neutral B, powerful move. Yeah.
There you go.
Sorry to get too into the weeds about Smash, but yeah, no, I do like her fighting style. I just think just the PG nature of the show just kind of, if they ever did like, they are going to do a live action mature thing, but it's going to be garbage if I'm being honest. But if they ever did a true to form live action rendition, I'd be interested to see what they do with her fighting style.
Yeah, that makes sense. I also love that as soon as the gang goes underground, Mei just like looks around disappointed and lets out a deep sigh.
And you are right. That's Mei's charm, that she's whenever she's on screen, she's just so done with it. She's just so done with everything happening around her.
Yeah, and I think that's so funny to have like a magical world where people are bending, like really cool universe, like different types of animals, and Mei just is not there for it. Like she just does not care.
I think you're turning me as a Mei fan. As we go on in season two, maybe I'll come around. I'll keep an eye on her a little more.
Maybe so. You will.
maybe. nice little pun there, Jacob. Look at you.
Zero out of four cabbages.
We'll move on to the next scene because they correct me if I'm wrong. It's Azula and Tyler. So it's Azula.
Yes.
Okay. So what happens is Azula goes back to the circus to recruit her old friend Ty Lee, who's joined the circus. And Ty Lee's hesitant, like I was talking at the top of the show, because she's enjoying. Ty Lee likes her life at the circus. She says it's her calling. And Azula has a key line here that I want to point out. I wrote it down because she says, "Well, I wouldn't want you to give up the life you live just to please me." And as a big Azula fan, I kind of want to track these like things she says, because Azula is lying here. She does want Tylee to give up her pleasant life and just to please her. Am I wrong here? This is a straight up lie.
You're totally right. This is the Azula mist in action. Yeah. You can't just tell her like give up your life and go with me, because Tylee would not be there for it. Instead, you have to trick Tylee, incept her, make her think it's her idea to come with you, and then she'll be loyal. I love how this scene starts. Just go back for a second.
It starts
upside down. Yes. And at first, like I'm always so confused when it comes on the screen. I'm like, wait, what's happening? I'm like, oh yeah, Ty Lee's just upside down. And perspective.
Avatar has a lot of cool shots like that. I feel like even when I see shots like this in live action movies, I think it's really cool. But Avatar just does an excellent job with these like transition shots. So you're right.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. But here, you're totally right. Azula's like, "Oh, I'd be so honored if you were to join me." And Ty Lee's like, "No, I'm so happy. My aura's never been pinker." And Azula's like, "Okay, like, don't do everything to please me." Total lie here. And I think Azula knows that she has a plan to get Ty Lee on her side.
But honestly, later on in the episode with the circus stuff, I think Ty Lee is wise to what Azula's doing. She just knows that sadly, if Ty Lee says no, Azula will just like burn the circus to down, I think, honestly. And I think Ty Lee is wary of that too. Because what does she say at the end? She's like, "Well, the circus was my calling, but Azula called a little louder." And I feel like that line, like, that shows Ty Lee is aware of what Azula is doing, but she also doesn't want to incur Azula's wrath, is what, at least that was my understanding of the whole situation.
See, I read her as just being oblivious, and she just like is so unaware that Azula was like manipulating the whole time and not just I don't know. Maybe we'll see.
And fans can write in what they thought too, because I'm curious.
One question I have for you, Zach, what color is your aura?
I think it's like something chill. I mean, we talked about this jokingly on another episode, I think, but blue was always what I go with usually, because I feel like red implies like an aggressive, intense aura, right? I would need somebody who understands all the auras to explain it to me further. But from what I understand, it's like red. I would have like a lighter, more chill aura. I think in my day-to-day life, I'm pretty like down to earth, monotonous, maybe not necessarily as wooden as Mei, but I'm kind of like Mei light in my day-to-day life. So something like chill. Yeah. What about yourself? What do you think?
Yeah, I think I'm probably probably a red would be my guess. I do think I come off as like pretty aggressive most times in my day-to-day life. I'm a very intense person. I was trying to think. So Ty Lee here says like my aura has never been pinker. Where's the pinkest that your aura ever is?
If pink implies like true happiness that it's never been truly pink. I don't know. Not to make this like super. No, but like, I don't know. I'm still, let me say this. I'm still finding my way through life in a way. So I don't think I'm ever truly, whereas Ty Lee seems to be in a job that she 100% loves and she seems to be having a good life. So I don't know when has my aura been the pinkest? Probably when maybe when I got my first acting gig, I guess that was when it was pink. I don't know. What about yourself, Jacob? When has your aura been its pinkest?
I was going to say right after the Cubs win a game and I'm in Virginia. That's when my aura is really pink. That's fair. That was my answer. But
every time my favorite basketball player, Nikola Jokic, makes a nice pass, that's when my aura is at its pinkest. So
it's pink all the time. That man drops dimes.
True. I mean, he's averaging a triple-double, man. He's a beat. The only person who could give him run for his money is Aang if he existed in real life. Probably be dropping quadruple-doubles.
That's fair. So then we wrap up that scene. We do get a nice little platypus bear that's just chilling. Not much to here, but I just want to point out that platypus bear is having a great time laying its egg.
Platypus bears, that's one of my favorite animals in the series. Like, if I had an animal companion in Avatar, I kind of would want it to be, besides Appa and the Sky Bison, I would want a platypus bear as like a homie. I don't know. They seem like cool animals.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. They can protect you quite well. You can ride on its back. Swim in water, like
exactly, because bears in real life, even I like bears. I think bears are cool animals, but I think they're too vicious and savage to ever befriend, even though there's always those videos of like Russian families like taming bears and like treating
them. So scary.
It is scary. I agree.
Yeah, I would not do that. Anyway, so on to the next scene that lacks bears. We have the leader of the resistance telling Aang about what happened to Amashu. Aang is like, oh, so King Bumi must be here. He's probably leading the resistance. And here the leader of the resistance says, no, on the day of the invasion, King Bumi surrendered before we even had a chance to fight. This does seem like true to form. This seems like something King Bumi would do.
Yes.
But a terrible idea. It does not make a ton of sense to me.
Yeah, I think if Bumi is going to do this, he has to like clue the soldiers in, because they're still fighting and they're still dying senseless deaths. I think Bumi's logic was, okay, if I surrender now, then less people will be dying. The Fire Nation is going to win regardless. If I surrender now, at least less people will pass away. So I can understand his logic, but you have to convey that to your soldiers, because this head of the resistance is angry with Bumi. You could tell in this scene, he's unhappy with Bumi's decision to not fight at all. And I think Bumi's flaw here is not surrendering, but it's not conveying that to the resistance, I think, the rest of the people there. What about you, Jacob? Yeah. Do you have any issues with the plan?
I mean, it definitely doesn't help that in the flashback, King Bumi's like, I'm going to do nothing, and then just starts laughing a ton. Like, that's not the best way to communicate. You know, being a king, I'm sure there are a few things you have to do. Like, you have to have the strategic vision. You have to, you know, make sure everyone's taken care of. But then you also have to communicate with your top leaders, because he really does hang the leader of the resistance out to dry. In terms of the conversation that happens here, I actually want to stop down on this and analyze it a bit. I think this really highlights the difference between an earthbender and an airbender. Here we have the leader of the resistance saying that we have to fight the Fire Nation. Fighting the Fire Nation is the only path to freedom, and freedom is worth dying for. And Aang is like, no, please don't die. Just leave Amashu. Like, you don't have to fight. You can just dip out and retreat. I think this really highlights the difference between an earthbender who's stuck in the ground and an airbender who's like seeing the other path out.
Yeah, no, that's a very astute observation on your part. Another thing that I thought this scene highlighted is how much Aang has matured as a leader. I think in season one, whenever Aang was reasoning with any like city official or anything like that, he did not do the best job. But here he's able to reason with this leader of the resistance who, while he is willing to die for his freedom, as we'll see right now, once Aang speaks up, some of his other soldiers were like, yeah, maybe we don't have to die. Maybe we should get out of here. So it seems like the leader of the resistance, he's willing to die for his freedom. But some of these other Earth Nation soldiers are like, yeah, we don't want to die in this meaningless war, which is completely fair. So I think Aang, not only is he able to reason with this Earth Nation resistance leader, he's able to actually get him to see his opinion, which is not something we really saw from season one Aang. So I thought Aang in this scene was very mature and actually did a good job leading.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think earlier Aang would just be really upset and maybe yell and say you're wrong. Here, Aang's a lot more persuasive. It's funny because the resistance leader is like, no, we have to take our home at any cost. And the randos are like, I don't know. I kind of want to live. Like, living is cool, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They're like, yeah, I kind of don't want to die, you know?
They're like, yeah, our home is cool, but so is my life. And it's pretty convincing. Pretty much immediately, the resistance leader's like, fine, that's okay. We can like leave, but how are we going to get everyone out? And that's
Sokka. Yes. Oh, I was just about to say, Sokka, while he couldn't figure out where Bumi was in the prison, he's able to devise this plan to get the remaining Earth civilians out, have them come down with a bad case of the pentapox. Brilliant plan, honestly. This is a very good plan, I think. And it works to perfection.
You know, the fear's already been stoked in some of those Fire Nation guards. They're already scared. Sokka is here with a good plan in order to spread this false pandemic. people a little bit worried. Yeah, I thought this was a good plan. Like, I actually don't see how this goes poorly. Even if one of the guards is like, I've never heard of pentapox. You're like, well, it's a local Earth Kingdom like disease. Yes. And then like they have to buy it. So I think that's pretty persuasive.
No, I agree. There's a lot of funny little things in this scene. So at one point, Fire Nation soldiers are like, they have the plague. And he just like is delivering that line, just him running away. Because the soldiers are not pretty. It's like a zombie apocalypse with Sokka leading the charge. Because Sokka's still got his red splotches from earlier. He's telling the Earth civilians to play it up. Make sure you look the sickest you can. And I thought this was like I talked about how Aang is mature. So Sokka's able to just lead this whole resistance into this like this pentapox zombie mob, and he's at the forefront putting his plan to action. I like Sokka a lot in this scene.
Yeah, so like Sokka and the rest of the Earth Kingdom like all run up. They walk just like zombies would in any of those like old movies where like the zombies are really slow moving. They're kind of like, and I think that this is like a great plan. You're totally right, Zach, that Sokka really does step up here and like execute this plan quite well.
Yeah, and then what happens at this is actually a funny May moment because her dad's like seeing all this happen, and then this is where her dad, the governor, is like, oh, I have heard of pentapox. And then he's like, so what will we do? And then she just offers, she's like, fireflakes, dad, in the most like dry monotone. And I will admit that did make me chuckle a little bit. So
especially because if you think back to season one, when Sokka tried fireflakes, his mouth was like on fire. And she's like one of those people who eat spicy food and she's like not hot.
She's not a bender. So she doesn't have like the natural resistance to heat that some firebenders may have. So I guess while May may be a little dry in real life, she likes the spice because she's just munching on those fireflakes like they're a generic name brand chip.
That's true. Are you a big fan of spicy food, Zach?
I am okay. Like, I think we talked about this too on Hot Ones. I would probably fail on Da Bomb. If anyone's familiar with Hot Ones, that's where I'm at. Like, I like spicy food, but I don't like it so hot where it doesn't taste like anything.
Yeah, no, that's fair. You know, I don't mind if spicy food tastes like nothing. I kind of like to feel the pain, especially like when I'm feeling sick. I like to just like clear it all out.
That's smart. And peppers are actually good for clearing your sinuses. Yeah. Oh, and then did you notice this is where Mai's brother, like right after the pentapox thing, there's a small shot of Mai's brother starting to walk away. Right here.
We notice this little kid toddling away. Little do we know that this is about to be the main crux of the episode.
Yes.
As boring as a plot point could be.
True. Well, we'll come back to that in a brief moment. So we cut back to Aang, and Aang finds Flopsy. If anybody remembers Flop, what is Flopsy exactly? Do they ever say what species Flopsy is? He's basically just this gargantuan behemoth of an animal that Bumi has domesticated.
I'm trying to think what Flopsy has. So definitely some goat in it, because there's like the big goat horns.
Almost looks like a bigger chupacabra in a way from Mexican lore, like in terms of his like grotesque face. I don't know what Flopsy is.
Yeah, there's like a little bit of rabbit, almost a little bit of gorilla with how built Flopsy is and how like strong.
Yes, I would agree with that.
So we see like Aang going through the streets, and I actually wanted to like stop for just a second. As Aang is like flying through all the streets, we see that the only thing that you have to do when you take over a city is just change the roofs. Like, have you noticed that in the background there was like a bunch of construction? There are like cranes and stuff, and like there were some roofs that were red and some roofs that were green, because like some had been taken over by the Fire Nation and some were like still OG Omashu.
No, I did not notice that. But why were they replacing the roofs? Couldn't they just paint them?
Yeah, maybe they could just paint them.
I mean, this is not the most riveting conversation to stop down on, but I'm just kind of curious about that. I didn't notice this.
I thought it was crazy to make it so easy to conquer. Just like all you have to do is change the roof color, and it's like, cool, we conquered it. It's ours.
True. You don't need to do anything else. You don't even kill anybody. You just run out of the town, paint the roofs, and that's it.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so we see Aang free Flopsy. Aang decides he's going to try to fly on Flopsy, uttering that classic yip yip, and Flopsy does not move a muscle. Flopsy does not flinch at all. Yip yip is not a code word or anything like that, and instead goes with a classic let's go.
Yeah, and then so him and Flopsy run off into the city, and meanwhile, Momo gets into the most intense battle of the episode, I would say, because Momo's involved in a scuffle with Mai's younger toddler brother, and this is the first time I thought in Avatar, why is this scene even being included, honestly? Because the reason I say this is because you can have this plot happen, you can have Tom Tom, which is his child's name, you can have Tom Tom escape, and just, you don't have to have this, like, chase to him sliding out, because it reminds me of all these, you know those, that trope in the movie, in the 90s, where they had all these movies where, like, it's like three men and a baby, where, like, the baby's just wandering off in the city, and, like, the baby gets into a bunch of zany hijinks. I feel like it was, like, a 90s trend of like multiple movies that followed this, and I felt like that's what they're doing with Tom Tom here, because Tom Tom ends up like rolling with Momo, then Momo ends up saving him of a bunch of little zany hijinks that go on. But I don't know, I was not too invested in anything going on in here, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, here we have we thought we only had two chase scenes. Here we actually
We have multiple. we do have a third here, you're right.
With Momo and Tom Tom. So what happens is Momo is really hungry, very classic Momo, and sees a bunch of berries. So goes in and starts eating a bunch of berries, and then as soon as he does, then this kid starts noticing him and follows Momo. What we get is a sort of chase scene where Momo's trying to get away from Tom Tom, and Tom Tom just thinks it's like a toy, essentially. Mm-hmm. It is actually the one part that I did like was that they used the mail delivery system again pretty cleverly.
Yeah, Tom Tom's like sliding in it, and then Momo does it. I'll give them credit because, like, I could see Momo like picking up Tom Tom and saving it. It's cool how like Momo initially goes from like scuffling with Tom Tom to like actually trying to help him and save him. And Momo does eventually actually help Tom Tom land safely. So look at Momo. So inspirational.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty lucky that Tom Tom ends up in the chute full of berries, because if not, then I don't think Momo lands on them, and I think Tom Tom's a goner.
True. I mean, Momo literally saves Tom Tom's life here. No joke. Like, Tom Tom probably dies in that delivery chute.
Yeah, imagine how mad the Fire Nation would be if they thought that they killed off Tom Tom.
True. Yeah, and what incompetence by the Fire Nation governor to just let his child wander off like this. It's not like the Earth Nation captures him. He just literally just doesn't keep track of his child, and his child just ends up in the hands of the Earth Nation, Earth Kingdom.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, you can picture this, right? You know, May was put in charge of babysitting. May got bored. May went somewhere else. Like, she knows it's on her, and what is she going to do? Like,
no, she doesn't obviously care. Maybe is willing to. I'm skipping ahead. Maybe is like willing to give up Tom Tom. She doesn't even love her younger brother. We'll get to that, but that end of the episode kind of shocked me. I don't want to skip too far ahead, but I have some thoughts. Basically,
yeah. You know. So we see Tom Tom join the rest of the Earth Kingdom Nation as they walk out of the city of Omashu, and I guess no one notices Tom Tom, and Tom Tom is fast because I assume everyone else is like walking at normal speed. And Tom Tom's like keeping up with them. So
he seems like a pretty energetic child, considering he goes on his whole adventure with Momo. So yeah, I guess Tom Tom just is a fast walker. And then we cut back to Criminal. It's Azula and Ty Lee once again. And we didn't really give Ty Lee the best introduction, so I'll stop down here. Ty Lee, what she is, she's this super flexible member of the Fire Nation. She's also like, she's not Fire Nation royalty, but she's from a rich Fire Nation family. I think later on they talk about how she has like six, she's the sixth of six sisters or something like that.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly.
It's fine, but basically she joins the circus from the Fire Nation to carve out an identity for herself, like away from the Fire Nation and do her own thing, which is pretty commendable, honestly. Like, it kind of sucks for Ty Lee. She's just doing her own thing, living out her life and her passions, and Azula has to just come in and drag her along to this avatar chase. Like, sucks for Ty Lee, really, because Ty Lee's relative to May is very, like, happy, go lucky, energetic, and bubbly. She almost is, in a weird way, like, there's a lot of parallels between Ty Lee and Aang, I would say. She's almost aloof in that regard, just like he is, I would say.
I think Ty Lee is, like, the closest that we see to Aang. Ty Lee is, like, even happier, even less bogged down. Like, we see Aang a lot of times as, like, weighed down by the responsibility he has to beat the Fire Nation. Ty Lee would never do that. Ty Lee has such an optimistic outlook. She really is just the happiest person. I think for some reason, like, Ty Lee just doesn't see evil in anyone. And I feel like in order to be friends with Azula, you either have to be completely oblivious and not see that people are bad, or apathetic like May and not care that your friend is evil.
Yeah, I guess. I don't want to say, I feel bad for, like, because this scene, we'll talk about it right now, actually, because, so Ty Lee is just doing her circus act. She's doing her thing on a tight rope, and Azula's watching, and Azula's getting this, like, royal treatment. And then she asks the, like, ringleader of the circus, do you think she'll fall? Do you think it'll make it more interesting if she fell? Or what about setting the net on fire? And, like, why are you putting on, this is your friend, like, oh, or supposed friend, and you're putting, like, so basically she forces the ringleader to remove the net, or initially she tells him to remove the net, and then she's like, actually, just set it on fire, and actually, why not release all the circus animals? Like, I understand you want Ty Lee to join, and you're trying to, like, push that point home, but this is a little much for somebody who you want to be your ally.
Yeah, you know, not only does she set the net on fire, but release all the animals. And we see the circus. We go to an outside view of the circus as just animal noises go off, and like fire looks like it's setting off. So Ty Lee, you know, I trust her as an acrobatic. I think she will do just a fine job of dealing with all these things. Like, she's not going to be in any danger, but it is a bit rude to do that, especially to a friend.
No, 100%. And I think this is just Azula drilling home the point, like, join me or I raise this place. I burn it to the ground. Honestly.
Yeah. Well, then the next thing we see is Aang, who did not raise the whole city to the ground. Instead, he comes back with Flopsy in tow, saying that he couldn't find Bumi. Then the leader of the resistance says, we just did a head count. And instead of having too few people, they actually have an extra person. We see Tom Tom just chilling around, hanging out.
Yeah, he's like riding, like, dragging on Momo's tail or something. Like, I feel like he's got a hold of Momo here when they cut back to him. Poor Momo can't just get this child off. He saves this child's life and it's still just, like, abusing him, sadly.
Yeah, you know, a trait for, like, Bumi for a baby is probably not that bad. Because if you, like, sure, the baby's not that useful, now at least. And Bumi is, like, a master earthbender, but expected value of lifetime on Bumi is, like, I don't know, 6 months. Like, that dude is so old.
Yeah, but nobody knows when he, I mean, people in the Avatar of the Ceremony universe can live a long time, because he's 100, but he's still, like, he's not senile. I mean, he may seem senile, but
he's
pretty
senile.
I mean, his brain's working enough to, like, actually, like, have plans for war. He will eventually lead this escape. So his brain's still working. I mean, his body looks like looks better than my, look, his body looks like he's 20. The only question is how long his brain's going to work. Like, Bumi might go full Alzheimer's and dementia, but I think in terms of, like, his athletic ability, I think he's gonna be kicking for a long time.
Yeah, you make a good point. You know, 110 still kicking it, still able to,
because Kyoshi lives to 200. I think they talk about that in this show. Like, she lives a long time. Even they mention it in Avatar The Last Airbender, not even just Korra, but so there are people in the Avatar The Last Airbender universe that can just live for centuries.
All right. Maybe it's not a good trade. You know, I was trying to make the best of it.
Oh, my bad. I didn't mean to.
No, that's all right. The next thing we see is we cut back to the governor's house. The governor is really upset. His wife is even more so upset, crying, as May just does not care. She is kind enough to give a handkerchief to her mom, so that's kind. But she's pretty bored by this as well. The governor surmises that the resistance kidnapped his son. And they're so tricky, just like Boomy.
Yeah, and that's where he delivers this line. And it's like, it's kind of crazy that how much respect Boomy commands across the nations. Like, I don't even know how, I wish he kind of got a backstory episode, because how did Boomy end up even become king? I feel like there's no, they never really like talk about it really. I wonder how Boomy's rise to power went.
It has to be hereditary, or else like someone would have been like, no, you're not king. You're crazy.
But is it hereditary or was it a power thing? Was he just the most powerful earthbender? Who knows?
I don't know. You could have put him in like a room by himself with like two stuffed animals and he would have thought he was king. Like, you could have tricked this man. He would not have known. He would not have been able to tell. One person that you can trick is Azula, and Azula is talking to Ty Lee after the performance saying, "Wow, you did such a great job. I can't wait to see how you top yourself tomorrow." And Azula is tilting Ty Lee a bit. I think Ty Lee here I actually can't have a show tomorrow. There's no more show. And I think the universe gave me a strong hint that we should have a career change.
Yeah, and I think this is Ty Lee, like, she's wary of what Azula's doing. I think maybe Ty Lee is just so above it all that she just doesn't see what Azula's doing. But I'm giving the character the benefit of the doubt here.
I actually think reading into it a bit more, I understand your perspective. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, she's like, the universe gave me a strong hint, and then says, I'll join you. Yeah, I think maybe.
The universe did give her the hint that hint was Azula and her crazy performance the night prior. That was the hint. So I think Ty Lee is telling the truth there. So we cut back to the Team Avatar and the Resistance. So we see the baby, Tom Tom. He starts like chewing on the sword. And like, man, this leader of the Resistance, like, he doesn't do anything wrong in this episode. He's not evil like the Earthbender we talked about last week? No, two weeks ago. Yeah, the preview. He's not evil like that guy, but man, he's such a Debbie Downer. He's like, well, you should, because Katara's like, oh wow, what a cute baby. He's like, well, you won't think he's so cute when he's grown up, then he'll be a killer, a Fire Nation killer. And it's like, yeah, I mean, of course, sure, he's Fire Nation, but yeah, the baby hasn't been corrupted by the Fire Nation yet. He's just a baby. Like, you're allowed to call it cute. I don't know. This guy just bites Katara's head off for like commenting on the baby being cute. I thought that was kind of dumb.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you know what? The leader of the Resistance is wrong. And I'm very happy that I get to point this out, because he is incorrect. This baby will not grow up to be a killer, because the war will be over by the time the baby grows up. The baby is just going to be a regular person. So you know what? This person got his panties all in a bunch for nothing. He's totally wrong, totally off base. I thought that was like an uncalled for statement.
Yeah, I thought it was uncalled for too. I have that in my notes. I was like, it's completely uncalled for from this guy. That's funny you use that word as well.
Yeah, like, thanks for saying that, I guess, but like, that's not helpful at all. The baby is pretty annoying though, like playing with the club and playing with all.
Yeah,
of
Sokka's he starts like chewing on Sokka's club, and Sokka's unhappy with that.
Yeah, it'd be pretty annoying too.
Yeah, so then we cut back to the governor sends them a note. They want to do a trade for the baby and King Boomy. And I don't think this is the worst trade ever, because you do raise a good point. Like, if there's a 110-year-old man, you don't know how much longer he's going to live for. But I thought this was a fair trade, contrary to what Azula says.
And yeah, speaking, you know, of what?
Oh, yeah,
continue. I was going to say, let's break it down. Who won the trade, Zach? Put your definitive stamp on it. Who won this trade between the governor and the Earthbenders?
Well, I mean, the Earthbenders objectively won, because they still have Tom Tom by the end of it, but then Aang just goes and delivers Tom Tom to the family, like, in secret, essentially, because they're going to get away. Aang gets away with Boomy. Like, he ultimately escapes Azula's wrath, because Azula calls off the trade, and this is Azula calling an audible that doesn't work out, I think, because Azula doesn't end up with Boomy. I think Boomy just chooses to stay. He could have earthbended himself out at any time.
Yeah, that is true. They could have walked away with Boomy and Tom Tom here. I think actually the governor totally would have made this trade. Like, he doesn't really care if he has Boomy. I think he much would prefer
just wants his baby back, which is understandable.
Yeah. I'm totally there for that. And I think
the governor was right. I think it was the issue was when Azula comes and she's like, okay, you're incompetent, you're a horrible leader, May's running the plan now. I think that was a bad decision in hindsight.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with you as well. Azula does come here and mess it all up. The next thing we see is Azula get to the city, and May's first statement to her is, please tell me you're here to kill me, which is kind of like a
dark,
big, dark joke for a kid's show. Like, I was surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I guess May is so apathetic to it all. She just ready. I guess May is very, very nihilistic as well, honestly. She just doesn't think her world is going to get any better, so.
Yeah, but we actually see May be pretty excited. I think both May and Azula laugh at this joke. They both embrace, you know, like, and are excited to be with each other.
Yeah, and Azula comes to Tylee. She comes to Tylee, and then Tylee says, like, yeah, Azula called a little louder than the circus did. Again, a pretty funny comment from Tylee there.
Yeah, unlike Tylee, who needed tons of persuasion, May is just like, yep, I will do whatever you want. Get me out of this place, and I will join your group. I think that this is a nice, funny moment with May. The next thing we see is Azula on the throne of this governor's mansion. The governor is saying, I'm so sorry. Like, you came at a terrible time. We're going to make a trade with the resistance to get my kid back. And this is the first time that we learn the kid's name is Tom Tom.
Yes.
You know, so many of these characters have great names. We have like Azula, Zuko, May, Tylee, even like Tyro or Haru.
Even like Jinju. Like Jinju's a cool name for a throwaway character. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. But Tom Tom, like that's F tier. That is such a bad name.
It's the worst name in the whole series, I think, for any character. It's the stupidest name. If I met somebody named Tom Tom in real life, I'd laugh in their face. I'm sorry. I just laugh. Like if your name is Tom Tom, it's embarrassing. I don't know what to
listener.
Say.
I'm so sorry, Tom Tom.
If there's a listener named Tom Tom, I'm sorry too, but I feel like it's one of those things where it's like, if you remember that website where you can look up how many of a name exist in a
yep.
I bet there's like 10 Tom Toms in America. None are listening to this.
I actually think all 10 do. I think this is their
really? You think this is the official Tom Tom podcast?
Yeah. Just like our official game is the Brawl Smash Ultimate. Their official podcast is Aang in there. They got to Aang in there with such a bad name, Zach.
Oh, true. They do have to hang. They're hanging in there their whole life with that name. Holy.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah. I mean, Tom Tom is a horrible name for a child. What can I say? But in to talk about this scene at length, it's more so like, wow, Azula comes here. She's already got the governor bowing to her feet. And I've honestly, in this scene, I felt horrible for this governor because he just gets absolutely embarrassed by Azula. She just gives him just such a tongue lashing. She really dresses him down. And she appoints his daughter, May, to oversee this trade due to his incompetence. And unlike Zuko in like season one, Azula, like every scene we see her in, she just commands the utmost respect from every Fire Nation official. She has like the governor of Omashu just on his knees bowing to her and obeying every one of her commands. I just think that's so insane, especially considering, again, she's a 14-year-old girl. Like, wow.
Yeah, for sure. She also decides to rename the city New Ozai and erect a statue of her dad.
Yeah, that's very impressive stuff from Azula, honestly. The fact that she's able to just come in, rename the city New Ozai. And honestly, you can kind of tell how Azula is with... Sorry, one second. How her relationship is with Ozai, honestly. Like the fact that she is Ozai's favorite child by far compared to Zuko.
Easily. Yeah. Not even that hard. The next thing that we see is a giant statue of Ozai getting built. As the camera comes down, we see the trade starting. We see Aang, Katara, and Sokka with a baby. And then we see three people leading the way with Mei rolling up. Then Bumi gets lowered down from a metal cage, and Bumi doesn't seem to care at all. Like, Bumi's just chilling. He's like, oh, hey, everyone. How's everyone doing? He's like a crazy old grandpa showing up to Thanksgiving.
Yeah, Bumi's just, he's happy. And I think Bumi knows, like, he knows the correct time to strike, honestly. Like, I think while he might have not gone about it the best, I think he knew that they were not winning this war for Omashu, so he was picking his battles. So I think ultimately he will be proven right when he eventually does free himself out of this metal coffin at the end of season 3. But yeah, for now, Bumi's content to just stay in his little metal coffin cell thing.
Yep, that's totally fair. And actually, Bumi's so okay with it that once Azula's like, I don't think this trade's fair. We're trading a 2-year-old for an earthbending king. Bumi's like, mm-hmm, yep, not fair. Like, he's like nodding along with him, which is funny. But yeah, so then Azula calls the deal off. And then Bumi's like, okay, see you later. And that's when Aang decides to jump up, get his glider ready, and start to airbend. Aang here like pulls his hat down as if it's going to be the tattoos that give him away. But I think as soon as he airbends, it's like pretty clear that he's the Avatar.
And how does Azula, how do both Azula and Bumi not recognize Aang? Like Azula should know how Aang looks like. There's a million wanted posters. And Bumi, you just saw Aang like a couple of months ago. I know he's wearing a hat, but how different does Aang look? Like, are there that many earthbending children or Earth Nation children built like Aang? Like, how is he not? How does he not have such a distinct face that neither of these two could? These two pretty intelligent characters, for the most part, could not recognize Aang, and his only disguise was him wearing a hat.
That
was
I definitely think for Bumi, I think the issue is cataracts. You know, he is 110.
True. He doesn't have his contacts in the cataracts. He might be blind. Exactly. Who knows?
His contacts probably dried out from being strung up in a metal cage all day. But Azula, yeah, she's got no excuse. You know, Aang's rocking a pretty sweet outfit. He changed his shawl into a hat to hide his tattoos. But it does seem like Azula should be able to tell. It's not until the tattoos are exposed that Azula's like, oh, that's the Avatar, like my lucky day. And we do hear Bumi, who's like, oh, Aang, is that you? Where did you come from? As if he's like a totally different person.
So what ends up happening is Aang knocks off Bumi's cell from the contraption that it's hanging off of, and he slides down one of the Omashu chutes, but Azula stays hot on his tail. And I mean, literally, she stays hot because she's blasting blue. At one point, she like blasts a wheel of fire at Aang. She's like sliding on a cart on a chute opposing them. So she's doing a bunch of stuff chasing. And meanwhile, Katara and Sokka are in a battle with Mei and Ty Lee. And Katara ends up freezing Mei, but then Ty Lee instantly paralyzes her. And I also liked how Sokka's like running away and you see like Ty Lee's hand pop up out of the floorboards. And like trip Sokka and like render him a mobile.
That came out of nowhere.
It was like a horror movie, honestly, except instead of like the hand of Jason, you just see like Ty Lee's little dainty hand pop up.
Yeah, that came out of nowhere. I didn't expect for the hand to come out of the floorboard. But yeah, so Ty Lee knocks Sokka down. Katara freezes Mei, and then Ty Lee gets her and takes away her bending temporarily as Katara is trying to summon the courage to get the water whip back up. It's not coming up. It's not able to work, and she's not able to bend. We switch to back to Aang and Bumi. After he freezes the chain, they're like falling down. More classic male delivery chute fights and chases as they are going down. We have a lot of gaffes where, you know, Azula's like in one of the chutes, and then she like goes under and like hides for a second. They think she's good, but no, then she pops back up. Lots of that sort of iconic chase stuff.
Yeah, like the classic stuff you get in any chasey. But Avatar does do these scenes well. I was just I didn't realize how much time prior to the episode that this chase scene took up. It was a long scene. A lot of stuff. Aang thinks he's got Azula off his tail at numerous points, but she keeps on chasing him. Eventually Aang will he'll get Azula off his tail, but he'll end up having this conversation with Bumi, and Aang's not happy with Bumi. He tells him, he's like, why didn't you free yourself? Why didn't you do all these things? Why did you stop? And Bumi explains the concept of Jing to Aang. So he says Jing is like the key to all bending. It says you need to use positive Jing when you're attacking and negative Jing when you're retreating. And Aang's like, I know about the Jing, because Aang must have heard all this stuff in like Air Nomad school once upon a time. But then Bumi explains neutral Jing. And he says neutral Jing is the key to earthbending. Neutral Jing is technically doing nothing, but he says he needs to know the correct time to strike. And so for that reason, he knows he has to stay. He tells Aang he'll need an earthbending teacher who's mastered neutral Jing in particular. Which is interesting. Yeah. They don't talk about Jing too much in the scope of the show, but I did want to stop down and talk about this discussion because it did interest me.
Yeah, this is stuff that's like more in the lore, explored a little bit more. You know, people have like talked about like the different types of Jing. In fact, King Bumi says there are 85 different types.
I wonder if he pulled that number out of his keister, or if that's a true statement. I wonder.
I'll trust Bumi. Why not give him the benefit of the doubt?
And he says Momo's mastered a few Jings himself, and that's why Momo is such a talented economist.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Momo bought it to GameStop early. Yeah, he got that stock, and it was so cheap.
Oh my gosh, GameStop is such a nightmare. That stock. Anyway, that's not what we're here for.
We're not. I was just making a throwaway joke from Walmart, to be honest.
The economics jing can die for
exactly a few minutes. his jing like bachelor's degree in economics.
Exactly. Appa's got a few more as well, like putting YOLO bets and foreclosing his house to bet on GameStop. Oh my god. Anyway, back to the actual episode. We have King Bumi saying, he can earthbend the entire time. He only surrendered because he wanted to wait and direct his energy where it needed to go. And so I think that this is like good perspective for why King Bumi, who seems so crazy, is doing a lot of his actions. He probably is really in touch with this neutral Jing and is in like understands that while his actions don't make sense to a lot of people, that they set him up well because
you're right. And I like Bumi overall as a character because I think they do a good job making him seem crazy, but he's a lot more intelligent than he appears. But I think he still should have conveyed this to the resistance, especially at least that one resistance leader, because no one else even wanted to fight. I'm sure if he told them, hey, I think we should not fight, we should just retreat for now, I think most of them would agree, except for the one. So I don't know. I think he should have done a better job conveying this to the citizens of Omashu. That's all. But it's not the worst plan.
Especially if he wants them to be better earthbenders, you definitely want to like say like, oh no, use your neutral Jing. Like this should be linguistic, like, or language that all of them understand. Like this should be common language between them. So we probably should have just said it, but it doesn't lead to the nice reveal that we have here as Bumi decides, he's going to go back. He's going to decide to get captured again. He says, I'll see you when the time is right. And he takes his rock and sends him right back up the chute, laughing like an incredibly crazy person.
Yeah, I forgot to mention this, though. Bumi this whole time could earthbend, which is another thing Aang asked him, because how they end up escaping Azula, Bumi, with just his head exposed, earthbends a rock that like shoots them far away. And Aang's like, yo, you could earthbend this whole time. Why don't you free yourself? Well, that's what he ends up doing. And it's crazy. Bumi can earthbend only with his head.
Yeah, and no one else that's possible. He says it like it's so obvious. He's like, well, yeah, they didn't cover my head. But like, no one would have thought to cover your head.
We've never seen anybody prior to Bumi earthbend with just their head. So honestly, I didn't even know this was possible for benders until I saw Bumi do it.
Exactly. Anyway.
Yeah, and Aang delivers Tom Tom in secret at night because Sokka and Azula did not take Tom Tom away, actually. They still had Tom Tom, but Aang secretly delivers him and the episode pretty much ends.
Yeah, this episode actually ends on a happy note. You know, so many of the episodes end on something negative. And even though we end with the Fire Nation, the scene right before this, we hear Mei saying, oh, we're going to track down your brother and uncle. And we learn from Ty Lee that Mei has a little crush on Zuko, which is fun. But yeah, this episode ends on a happy note. We have Tom Tom reignited with the rest of his family. Or reunited, not ignited.
He's not set on fire. That's another baby in TV and film. I'm Jack. He's not Jack, ignited. Yeah.
Of course. But yeah, so I think this episode ends on a happy note and fades off to black. So there you go. That is Return to Omashu. Zach, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I enjoyed this episode, honestly, on a rewatch, but I think a lot of it is set up, but I think it's fun. I think my issue is I would have preferred if instead of a chase scene, they had a more conventional fight scene, but I think because it was the Return to Omashu, the creators and like the animators are like, we want to use these shoots once again, but I felt like, I don't know, it was a little played out for me, and it was a little long. That was my issue with it. The overall writing and plot in this episode was good, and I thought the comedy landed. I like Sokka and the villagers with the Pentabox. So I enjoyed this episode, but I think there are a couple of things that could have been a little better. What about you, Jacob?
Yeah, I agree with you. The like multiple chase scenes kind of get a little bit old. I love the mail delivery system. I like that it's used as like a way to get away. And ultimately, like it has to be more of like a chase rather than a fight, because I don't think you want like one group to win, because Bumi needs to have that conversation with Aang. So I kind
of understand. You're right. It makes sense within the scope of the show. Like this is not a show that has, or this is not an episode that has any like plot holes within the writing or anything. Yeah. But just in terms of a viewer, what I like to see, I don't know. The chase got a little boring, if I'm being honest.
No, I agree with you. But ultimately, this is a good episode. You know, I love seeing Boomy. The introduction of May and Ty Lee are great. We really have the series set up. Very few characters other than Toph, of course, will get introduced and be so consequential. We kind of have the bad guys all set up. Like, all of their pieces are now on the board. We have May and Ty Lee ready to go. We have the whole Zuko and Iroh story. We have Ozai. The whole bad guys are set up. And all we have to do is introduce that last Toph piece to have the whole board set up before the events just go for the next two seasons.
Yeah, so where do you want to go here, Jacob? You want to give our episode ratings?
Yeah, let's give our episode rankings. As always, you can write in with your episode rankings. Your ranking will be averaged in for the listener ranking and then combined with Zach's ranking and my ranking to get the official Aang in there ranking from 0 to 4 cabbages. Zach, you want to start us off?
Yeah, I'll give this episode a 3.3 out of 4. That's my line. Right. I think that's like, that's a, if you're scoring it, that's like close to 80%. And I think that's like what I'll give. I'll give this like a B plus for an episode. What about yourself, Jacob?
So I'm right there with you. I'm at a 3.4. I think this is a good episode. This is an episode that I think of fondly when I look back on it. This does a great job of introducing. It's just like the first episode, the Avatar State. A lot of exposition without making the entire episode suffer. And that's hard. I feel like that's not something.
Yeah, the movie struggled with that, which we talked about. Yeah. Like all exposition, whereas the writers of Avatar The Last Airbender throughout the whole series do an excellent job setting it up, setting up what's going to happen in the series with it still feeling fresh and entertaining. So excellent job by the writers.
Yeah, and the listeners are right there with us at a 3.32, leaving this episode at a 3.34.
Yeah, so. And I think that's about right. Sometimes I disagree. Sometimes I think the listeners are too high on stuff. Other times I think the listeners are too low. But this, I think I'm in agreement with the listeners. I think that's about right for where this episode should go.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is right where the episode ought to be. Now we can rank the battle, or I guess chase, rather. Here we have the chase scene at the end. It comprises like the fight between Azula's gang and Team Avatar, as well as the chase of Azula and Boomy. Zach, you want to start us off on the fight ranking?
Yeah, we didn't go into great detail, but there were a lot of little things that I enjoyed in this fight. Like I talked about Azula, at one point she shoots like a wheel of flame in Aang, which I thought was really cool. It was a firebending technique that I had not seen in any episode we watched prior to this. I think Katara utilizing the octopus style, or like the water whip on both hands, she like grabs Mei with that at one point. So I love when Katara's fighting like that. But overall, I kind of, and honestly, you know what I wish? I wish the episode on focused even more on the scuffle of Katara and Sokka between Mei and Ty Lee rather than the Azula Aang chase, but they had to do that. So that was what I, for, so altogether for those two fights, I'll give that a 3.1 out of 4. What about yourself, Jacob?
Yeah, I think I'm actually right there at a 3.1 with you.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah, I think we're right there, simpatico together. This is an interesting fight. You know, it's the first time we see Mei, Ty Lee, and Azula all fighting together. We've seen, you know, Mei and Azula by themselves, but we get to see like this sort of like bad guy group. I like seeing Ty Lee's fighting. It's fun to see someone who's like whipping around with as much, I guess, agility as Aang does. Here, I think that, yeah, the fight does suffer a bit just because it seems to go on for a while. There are some like neat tricks on the mail delivery system, but I agree. I would have liked to see Ty Lee and Mei face off against Katara and Sokka a bit longer.
Yeah,
we do get a cool moment where Mei's like, how are you going to fight without your bending? And Sokka's like, I seem to manage. And Sokka like hits Mei to the ground with a boomerang. Mm-hmm. That was like a pretty cool moment. But ultimately, I think it falls a bit flat. And this is not like one of the best fights, but still, over 3 out of 4. Nothing to complain about.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with your ranking because we have the exact same one. So there we go.
Disagree there. There you go. Not much listener feedback this time. Lydia.
That's on me, but you know why? Because I forgot to post a question thread. My apologies, everyone. This week I dropped the ball. There will be a question thread next week for sure. And you can always write in. You know where you can write in? at posterrecaps.com/ATLA. Is that? No, that's where they leave the reviews.
That's where you can leave those 5-star reviews. Yeah. You can write in avatar@posterrecaps.com.
Not Tom.
Or tweeted us at Post-Show Recaps, and we will be sure to incorporate your feedback.
Yeah, exactly. If you have any questions and you think like, oh, we're not somehow missing it through the email, even though we always see every email that we get sent in, feel free to tweet directly at us. You can get any question you want answered from the horse's mouth, because we're all, me and Jacob are very open to any feedback through Twitter and anything like that.
Yeah, happy to have more Avatar discourse in the world. Lydia did write in, though. She said, so Azula is being rude to Ty Lee with a whole, our parents didn't send us to the Royal Fire Academy for girls for you to join the circus, which is very on brand for her. Fine character development. But then you remember she's 14, so she's just name dropping your middle school. Thus, I challenge you to name drop your middle school during the episode or form a traditional inquiry. Come up with any scenario where you could name drop your middle school in real life and not end up looking foolish.
Well, see, the issue is there are no middle schools in Canada. We only have elementary school and post and secondary school. And that's so like high school, you have elementary school and high school, and that's it. So from kindergarten to seventh grade is elementary. And from eighth grade to 12th grade is just high school. There's no like 7, 8, 9. The only reason I know about middle school is because I watch a lot of American TV shows. So that's the only reason why I know anything about middle schools.
Wow.
I still can answer this question because I can just use my elementary school. And in the seventh grade, I switched to another school. So I can give this an answer, but I'll let you take it first, Jacob.
Well, here I'm learning all about the different types of schooling systems in our neighbor to the north. I did not know. I assume that middle school is common. So I went to West Middle School. I was in the theater magnet at the school. To work that into normal conversation and not seem like I was either forcing it in or seeming foolish would be quite hard. In fact, I was trying to do it during the episode, like find the time to mention it. And I just can't. Like, it's so odd. Like, your high school makes sense, even like elementary, like fond memories. But those middle school years, like those two awkward years that I like did not enjoy, I feel like it'd be hard to drop. So I feel like the only thing that you could do is maybe if like the Broncos were playing a football game, our mascot was the Broncos. So maybe I could mention it there. That's my best shot.
Yeah, for me, I'm lucky. It's easy to name drop my elementary school because I went to this Muslim private school in our predominantly Asian city. So like every Muslim person who went to high school, other high schools in the surrounding area, a lot of them like came from that school. It was called BC Muslim School. Horrible elementary, to be honest. But it was a quote unquote private school, but it was the most ghetto private school ever. But because of that, I never really have any trouble working it into conversation because I'm always telling funny stories from like my school life in school. Especially that elementary was wild. A lot of crazy stuff happened. But I remember I'd always get into trouble at school and you would have to write these disciplinary reports. They'd send you home. You have to get your mom to sign them. But I would forge my mom's signature so she would never know I was getting in trouble. I'd trace her because my handwriting is disgusting, but I'd trace over her signature. So I was able to get away with getting in trouble at my elementary school. But yeah, it's easier to name drop an elementary school. If I actually went to middle school, I'd struggle name dropping it. So it's a tough for you. West Middle School, pretty generic name. I don't know how you would slot that into
conversation. Yeah, West is pretty generic. The other one in the town was Westwood. Not much better. But yeah, like the schools were generic. Here, I'm learning new things about you, Zach. I didn't know that you were an Azula type in your childhood, forging your mom's signature.
Yeah, and I think it was like, because when I was at home, I was very well behaved, honestly. But when I went to school, I was just like, man, I just want to have fun, mess around. I was not the worst behaved kid. I never did anything too bad. But yeah, I don't know. I like to have my fun. I mellowed out in high school, but in elementary, I was pretty wild. What can I say?
Yeah, I feel like that happens to a lot of people. I was the same way. You know, we talked earlier.
Yes, we did talk about
how you get kicked out of class. So
we have talked about that on the air before. But yeah, I mean, if I find another
school days.
if I not find another funny story from like my middle schooling years when I was in elementary and like early high school, I'll tell it on the podcast. But yeah, great question from Lydia as always. And yeah, maybe one of these days we'll get Lydia on the show, because we don't have a guest for the TOF episode, but we should get a test. Maybe we'll talk about that off air. But
okay. Yeah. We can work that out. That's a great episode coming up in 2 weeks. So
yeah, it's going to be great. I feel like we definitely need a guest for that one though, regardless of wherever it is. So we'll talk about it off air.
It is a really good episode. Anyway,
do you want to jump into our tea quartet? So it's the final segment. You guys know how we do it usually if you've been listening to this before. So we take four fictional or non-fictional characters, we slot them into bending classes, and we decide what type of bender they would be. And today we're doing Team Iron Man from Avengers. So Jacob, do you want to talk about the four characters we're going to be doing?
Yeah, so we're going to be doing Iron Man himself, we're going to be doing Spider-Man, Vision, and Black Panther.
And I want to make a note here, because we did announce on the show we were going to do Black Widow. The issue is Black Widow, I think there's a more obvious firebender here, so we can't slot Black Widow there. And like, we didn't want to just, you know, put her in the water. I don't think Black Widow's a waterbender. So instead, we decided to change her out with Vision, because we didn't announce we were going to do Black Widow on the show. So don't want to disappoint any Black Widow fans there. But instead, we might as well start off with the waterbender we replaced her with, Vision. And the thing with Vision is, like, out of all these guys, he's the most calm by far. He's the most reserved. But at the same time, he is open to change, and waterbending is the element of change, because I feel like he's a robot. He's attracted to this human, Scarlet Witch. So of course he has to be willing to change and not live the way he normally lives, like a generic robot lifestyle. What do you have to add on to that, Jacob? What are your thoughts on the waterbender here?
If you think about Vision, Vision starts off as Jarvis, like the AI assistant, at least in the MCU. He's like starting off as like, you know, helping out, always there to, you know, assist Iron Man. Then Ultron kind of like takes him over, and he then becomes his final form in Vision. So if you go through like the path that he has, like, he is very versatile. He's doing many different things in his different capacities. He has so many different types of powers. In that way, he's kind of like a waterbender. The way that he fights, he can like phase in and out of existence. So in that way, like, he's kind of flowing in and out of reality. And I think he's the one who's very rational, hyper focused on like that sort of rational side of himself. I think that makes him the waterbender, because he kind of has gotten past his emotions and like only lets them help influence him and like help make things better and not like detract away. Yeah, so I think he's the waterbender.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And I think the next person who's probably even easier to peg is Spider-Man as our airbender. I think I don't even think it needs much explaining. I mean, Spider-Man, like Peter Parker, he's so similar to Aang. J. Jonah Jameson, fun fact, the actor who plays him, J.K. Simmons, I think is his name, also voices Tenzin in The Legend of Korra. So look at that. Yeah, there's even a Spider-Man to airbender connection right there.
There you go. Well, I definitely think that Spider-Man is the airbender here. You know, every iteration of Spider-Man, except for Spider-Man 3, where Tobey Maguire's brooding as Venom, is airbender. Just the character of Peter Parker is made to be an airbender.
Yes. Yeah. He's a high school student in some depictions. Others, he's in college. He's always working for, what is it, the Daily Bugle? Is that the name of his magazine?
Yeah.
He's always doing his thing there. But you can tell, like, while he's young, he does have these good leadership qualities. But at the same time, even when he's fighting these villains, he's always sees the fun in it. He always, like, every Spider-Man cartoon you watch, Spider-Man's got like a funny joke in the middle of combat with a villain, which I think is a very airbendery trait, to not take these any fight that seriously. So yeah, I think by far he's the easiest to peg, Spider-Man as our airbender.
I agree with you there. I think the next easy one is Iron Man as the firebender. You know, he's like the playboy millionaire. He's, you know, out on the town having a great time, very charismatic, very aggressive. He literally creates a robot that like fires off rockets. Like, this man is showy. He's flashy. He's the firebender of the group for sure.
Yeah, I agree. He's one of the few superheroes whose personality is out there. He's not like his DC counterpart, Bruce Wayne, who's anonymous to the public. So yeah, I think it makes sense to have him as our firebender. He's very showy. He's very flashy with everything he does. So yeah, for that reason. Yeah, and completely makes sense to have him as our firebender. And the last person we have is King T'Challa, the Black Panther, as our earthbender. And I think this makes sense because earthbenders are usually not willing to change, or like they're very like steadfast with stuff they do. And the thing with T'Challa is like he did not want to open he did not want to open Wakanda to the rest of the world. That's what Killmonger wanted to do, so Wakandans all over the place could benefit from their surplus supply of vibranium. So for that reason, I feel like it is a little bit of a stretch, but I think King T'Challa is pretty earthbender. I mean, he's a strong, powerful earthbender, which begs the question, who would win, King T'Challa or King Bumi?
Ooh, what a difficult question. Honestly, that would be quite the fight to see. You know, you have King Bumi throwing rocks at him, Black Panther taking the energy and then redirecting it right back at him.
It's like, how powerful is vibranium relative to like the average rock? Because vibranium is one of the most powerful substances in the like Marvel universe, I'm pretty sure. It's up there.
Yeah, it's definitely stronger than any rock. Mm-hmm. Like if you just like threw a rock at vibranium, like the vibranium would beat the rock. So I'm tempted to say that Black Panther gets the dub here.
I think so. I mean, I love Bumi, but I think especially when you're not the Avatar, you're always going to be limited by having only one bending ability. Whereas I think like I would pick Aang over T'Challa, but Bumi here, I would go with King T'Challa as well.
Yeah, I think that if there's any sort of metal bending involved, then Black Panther's just destroyed. Because
so you think Toph, like let's say adult Toph in her
TKO
athletic prime, TKO, you think, no question.
Yeah, because you just take the vibranium in his suit and you just like take it out, and now he's just fighting. Like you just wreck
true,
him.
True.
Like, it's easy.
He doesn't have any superhuman abilities. You're a bigger Marvel expert than me. Is it his suit that grants him all his power?
No, he definitely does, but like you could use the metal in his suit to just like confine him to where he can't move. So,
I didn't even think of that prior, but you're right. Yeah, so I guess Toph does just destroy King T'Challa.
Well, Toph is like one of the most powerful people, so it makes sense. But there you go. That's our T quartet. We have Spider-Man as the airbender, we have Vision as the waterbender, Iron Man as the firebender, and King T'Challa, Black Panther, as our earthbender. Next week, we'll be coming back with something very similar in the series. We'll be doing Team Captain America. That'll be Captain America, Ant-Man, Hawkeye, and Winter Soldier. Maybe Scarlet Witch.
Yeah, maybe Scarlet Witch. I think Scarlet, because Winter Soldier, like, who the hell cares about Bucky? Let's be real. Do people give a shit? I'm sorry, like, I'm part of my language, but do people care about, I don't know.
I like Bucky Barnes. Like,
I think WandaVision is more, like, hit people are watching WandaVision. Okay, like, I think people like the Scarlet Witch. Might as well go with what's popular, so.
All right, yeah, sounds good.
Black Widow, I know people care about. That's why I had to give the disclaimer. Bucky, I think if we removed him, we wouldn't even have to say anything. I don't think any Bucky fans will be deep into the comments, so I'm not too worried.
Bucky to the wind, Bucky out of here. Here we are, perfect. Standing Scarlet Witch. We put Vision perfect. In. Maybe when Black Widow comes out eventually, like in May, we can do something about
that. No, we'll incorporate her because I just think she's not a waterbender, and it would have been lazy to slot her as a waterbender. So I am glad. Like, we'll find a spot to place her as a bender. But yeah, on that note, thanks to everybody who listens. You can follow me on Twitter at ZachMuhammad32. And where can they follow you, Jacob?
At JK Redman.
Perfect. Thanks a lot, everyone. Peace out.
Bye.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.